As far as price action ending this year, I think we're at or over 100K. I think it hits the fan probably September, especially in Q4. And so I think things actually start to move aggressively in Q4 and you see this thing catch up to where it's supposed to be. I think Bitcoin's dislocated and mispriced. So that's my prediction. And then I think we really aggressively blow off in 2025. So I think we end the year, you know, 100K, 125K or something, and you can see a Bitcoin price as high as 500, 600, 700K in 25 or maybe the beginning of 26. I think it blows off. But I don't really think it matters. I think they got to print a lot of money no matter what. And I think you're going to see one of the biggest asset bull markets in human history, because when the Fed hikes interest rates, they're trying to get money back into their ecosystem. They want money into treasuries. They want money in the sovereign debt market. They want money in the bond market. And the world is saying, you, we don't want those pieces of trash. So for the first time since the mid 1800s, we're in a very severe bond bear market. And so in my opinion, in Bitcoin, everyone's treated equally, fair rights, no matter who you are, no matter your height, skin color, eye color, doesn't matter.
Well, what do you take of the possibility of, you know, the government potentially printing US dollars to buy Bitcoin at this point? I mean, like, theoretically, we're like the only country that could do that, right?
Like, as a Bitcoiner, I think you got to rip the band-aid, you got to print, and you got to just say, you know what, we f***ed up, let's enter a new era. But do I think that's going to happen?
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where we've got the man, the myth, the legend, Jack Maulers himself in the house. Jack needs little introduction, but he's the CEO of Strike, the global Bitcoin app, bringing Bitcoin accessibility to millions across the globe. We'll get into all that and more, but first, we've had some shit hit the fan here, Jack. Japan raised interest rates by a measly 25 basis points. We've had the stock market crash and Bitcoin crash to 50K. So, Jack, tell me, man, what the hell's going on here?
Well, first of all, my friend, I appreciate you having me. I've become a fan of the show, as I just told you. So it's an honor, and I'm ready to rock and roll. I don't know if you want me to walk you through the carry trade, but I think the financial system is just very fragile. We live in our modern day financial system is money that isn't backed by anything. It's printed out of thin air and relies heavily on trust. And so I think you just saw the fragility of the global financial system, which terrifies people. And again, when that trust breaks, things cascade on itself and problems can happen very quickly. So not shocking to a Bitcoiner, probably not shocking to your listeners, but it is the reality we live in, where the global financial system is managed by few key central banks. And when someone makes an oopsie or a decision or tightens policy, they collapse the whole set of dominoes.
Yeah, but I mean, this is like one of the biggest crashes here, I guess, of our lifetime, right? We've had the COVID crash. And, you know, then 2008. So then why, and like the Lehman crash and everything like that. So, you know, why is it just the 25 basis point hike from Japan that has made this thing collapse so much? I mean, it seems like it's just a minuscule amount, right? I mean, I thought the US was supposed to be the global, you know, reserve currency with the dollar, and we were the ones supposed to be running everything. So why, you know, Japan all of a sudden has all this power, and why is it causing such a ruckus in the market?
Yeah. So my thesis as for this cycle in Bitcoin, and I've made some bold price predictions, is highly predicated on the sovereign debt crisis. So it's the debt crisis. It's the demand for United States government debt, which also is known as the bond market. And so what has happened is you had record money printing through COVID. So COVID, I think, was close to 40% of the US dollars that exist today were printed in the last 4 years. So excessive money printing, which leads to inflation. That's going to inflate the prices of goods and services. There's more currency issued than there are scrambled eggs, than there are Caesar salads, especially than there are Bitcoins, especially than there are Miami real estate, right? Then the way to stop that is to tighten monetary policy, which is effectively deleting dollars from the market, so that if you reduce the quantity of dollars, you're bringing the prices back down. The way to achieve that is to increase the cost of capital, is the interest rate. So they raised rates as fast as possible. All of that volatility in manipulating the value of money, which is really effectively our time and energy in an abstracted form, causes a lot of stress on the market, one of which has been the sovereign debt market, has been the bond market. So for the first time since the mid-1800s, we're in a very severe bond bear market. And so in my opinion, all of this unravels from that core idea, is that we've never been in a worse bear market for bonds, government bonds, unless you go back to 1860. So what actually happened is all of our wealth is stored in assets. You cannot store your wealth, your time, your energy in a fiat currency, because over time, fiat currencies are actively being debased. They're being inflated. They're worth less each day on average if you pan out over a long enough time span. So when they hike rates up as fast as they have and immediately start crashing banks like Silicon Valley Bank, traditionally you run to the bond market. Traditionally you get, you know, risk-free interest rate, 5.5%. Why would you ever own gold? Why would you ever own Bitcoin? Unless there's a crisis in that market, unless those things are down 60, 70%. Then you got to go somewhere else. So what investors figured out is, hold on a second, Japan, they have zero interest rates. They still have no cost of capital. I can actually go borrow money in Japan instead of the United States of America, take the yen, swap it for dollars, and then use the dollars to buy the assets and hide in the assets. And so when you see gold making new highs despite high interest rates, when you see Bitcoin making new highs despite high interest rates, when you see real estate market not crashing, you're seeing Nvidia and the S&P 500 still ripping. You know, times are still inflationary despite high rates. So there was still a lot of buy pressure, buy side on assets. And some of that was coming from what we're calling this carry trade, is the world went and found where money was free. So even though the Federal Reserve had the hardest monetary policy as a central bank relative to a lot of the other central banks, the world was still able to go borrow free money, swap it into dollars, and then buy a lot of the hard assets, quote unquote, that the world desires, which are traditionally American-based assets, which are tech companies in the United States of America, real estate in the United States of America. So as soon as Japan started to tighten monetary policy, which you can effectively suck in the air out of the room, you say, hey, all that free money borrowing, come back to daddy. Then you start to see these assets sell off. And usually what happens is the financial system, again, it's all on trust. It's all on promises. It's all on thin air. So what you usually see is people get blown out. So what it looks like happened is Monday morning, it smelled like dead bodies in the water. So I think that there are probably some dead bodies out there that had to be forced sellers. It's a difference if you're unwinding a position versus if you're forcefully being liquidated. And you can see that in how violent the markets can get. So it looks to me like someone was caught offside, someone borrowed a little too much free money and had to puke a bunch of assets that they bought with that free money, which then causes something like Bitcoin to go down 20% and the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones. So that's what happened technically. But I think on a broader scale, when the Fed hikes interest rates, they're trying to get money back into their ecosystem. They want money into treasuries. They want money in the sovereign debt market. They want money in the bond market. And the world is saying, fuck you. We don't want those pieces of trash. We don't understand the deficits you've created. We don't believe in the future of the dollar. And so this is now creating these type of weird market dynamics. I think this will be the first of many sort of really puke-worthy collapses and tragedies where people are like, what's going on? You know, there's no war. There's no COVID. Yeah, but you've got a sovereign debt crisis and it's just starting to rear its head, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I mean, with all that, right, it becomes more volatile when everything starts to hit the fan with more money circulating in the market and everything like that. And you mentioned already, you've had some bullish price predictions with Bitcoin already in this cycle. I think I've heard it upwards of $1 million per, per coin for this cycle. So even with shit already starting to hit the fan, you know, where do you see this going? Are you still as bullish as ever because, you know, people are going to find some safety and some security in Bitcoin? Or do you see it on the flip side of things where there's just blood in the streets and there's going to be blood in the streets? And because Bitcoin's the most liquid asset there is, people are just going to be selling off.
No, I'm bullish. I think this event is actually bullish for asset prices. The total money supply is going up. It's broken out. I think the market, listen, markets in times of crisis sell what they can, not what they want. If you in real time on a Sunday night owe a bank in Japan $100 million, $1 billion, you can't wait for market open on Monday to sell the piece of shit stock portfolio that you want to give them. You got to dump your Bitcoin. And so what that does, what does that do? That naturally misprices assets. You've got a lot of sell pressure on assets that you can sell, not that you want to sell. So that's when you get a market dislocation. So I think Bitcoin is dislocated from where it's probably naturally supposed to be priced, and it will go find that over the coming months. And then I think we're going to get the most money printing in human history. Central banks progressively try and price fix things. In 08, it was the housing market. And now it's the sovereign debt market. It's the bond market. It's the holy mecca of markets. When people say we left the gold standard and we went on the dollar standard, not really. We didn't go on the dollar standard. Not all the wealth, not, you know, the richest guy in the world doesn't have a bunch of dollars. All the banks own bonds, right? We went on the government debt. We went on the bond standard. And so if they're going to have to bail that thing out, that's the holy mecca. That's the final boss. The amount of stimulus it's going to take to bail that thing out and remain solvent, I think Bitcoin lands somewhere between 250 to a million this cycle for that very reason. So I don't know, all the market events, like I said, you know, I don't want to be too casual in an economic crisis, but this is exactly how I expect it to go. The beast is rearing its head. They're going to have to print. They've already started. People look at interest rates. They watch interest rates way too closely. It doesn't matter. They cut rates. It doesn't matter. It's how much money is there out there, not the cost of it. They are printing. And so I think Bitcoin makes a historic run.
Yeah. And there has been a lot of historic events here that have happened recently in Bitcoin. I mean, I was there when you were announcing El Salvador's legal tender with Nayib Bukele. And, you know, we recently just had the Bitcoin conference here with President Trump. You know, take what you want from his speech, but the fact that he's there kind of speaking about Bitcoin is a big deal. Senator Cynthia Lummis has proposed a bill for the U.S. to use Bitcoin as a strategic reserve asset. Now, you've been in Bitcoin for a while now. Did you think we were going to get to this point this quickly as things are seemingly kind of falling apart?
Man, that's a good question. I mean, I would say part of me said absolutely not. And then the other part of me said, of course. You know, the part of me that said absolutely not is if you're an engineer or an entrepreneur or a podcaster in this space and you live day in, day out trying to change the world through this revolution, through this movement, it's hard to zoom out and appreciate these milestones. And sometimes when they smack you right in the face, like you go walk into a building and there's the leading presidential candidate, you're like, holy shit. So that part of me, no, I mean, it's been a grind. And sometimes these milestones hit you right in the nose and you didn't even realize how close you were to the target. But on the other side, you know, the reason I've committed my life to Bitcoin and so many others have is because it has that, you know, level of change. I think it can change the world in such an astronomical way. And the adoption of it is just so natural. You know, at the baseline, no matter who you are, you're better off on Bitcoin's team than against it, period. Doesn't matter who you are. And so very naturally, everyone finds themselves on Bitcoin's team. And so it doesn't surprise me. I mean, when someone says, aren't you shocked that guy likes Bitcoin? No, because people aren't stupid. It's in their best interest to like Bitcoin. So I love the safe quote, you know, Bitcoin will be adopted like gunpowder. For those that don't adopt it, you'll become its victim. So no, in that respect, business as usual, everyone, you know, money is the most important market good in a civilization. It's time and energy in an abstracted form. It's the core technology humans need to continue to iterate on to be healthy and flourish. And so, yeah, everyone between the president of the United States and your cousin is going to naturally adopt it.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, that's where I see a lot of difference in this cycle, you know, where we've, you know, last cycle we had, you know, Bukele, who I already mentioned, El Salvador, get onto the Bitcoin standard, make Bitcoin legal tender. But how much weight do you put in of, you know, the potential of using Bitcoin as a strategic reserve asset for the United States? Like, you know, I always see the meme on Twitter where you see, you know, the empires rise and then fall and another one's going up. And the one that's been circulating in Bitcoin Twitter is Bitcoin starting to rise up. Now, do you think that Bitcoin as a strategic reserve asset for the US would, I guess, prolong that United States dynasty in a sense where, you know, maybe we make the dollar stronger for a while, but, you know, Bitcoin's inevitable and we're all human, right? So the government's going to fail eventually, but maybe it just delays that a little bit and things don't quite crash and burn? Or do you see it as maybe just a ploy to get some votes at this point? And, you know, there's not going to be much change because, you know, the train's already left the tracks.
I mean, listen, probably a lot of the above of what you just said. If I was going to be buying 1 to 5 million Bitcoins, which it depends, I think, whether you're taking Trump and Lummis or you're taking RFK. But if I was trying to fill that order, I would probably tell you guys that I liked Bitcoin and I was interested in that after I bought them, right? And so if I was interested in votes, I'd tell you before I bought them and was elected in office. If I wanted the coins, I would let you guys trade Bitcoin at 55K before I bought them, right? So clearly they want votes, or else they would go buy the Bitcoin first and then say, hey, actually, the United States really loves it. You guys can go bid it up to 500K now. So they clearly want votes. With that being said, I think this is a massive, massive deal. And I, again, a huge catalyst. You know, I do think where to start with this one? First of all, you know, the United States, again, it needs to monetize its debt. It needs demand for its debt. If you're losing demand in promises you're making about your future, you know, how can you give confidence in a deficit? How can you give confidence in a promise as you back it with something hard? And so I think that's where Lummis and the proposal starts first, is let's put something real behind these deficits. Let's put something real behind these promises. Let's give people some confidence that at least we give a shit. Because if government deficits aren't going to slow down, if we're not going to stop spending, we have to instill confidence in the rest of the world, because clearly they're upset. Bond markets are getting obliterated. All of our banks are insolvent. If you run the financials on Bank of America, they are technically and functionally insolvent. And so we have to start instilling confidence in folks. If we lean into technology, we lean into growth, we lean into hard assets, we lean into hard money, hopefully that's a first step. Does it solve the problems? No. And I don't think I heard Trump or Lummis claim that they plan on solving the problems anytime soon. They're talking about 20-year timeframes, but it's a confidence game. So I think that that's kind of the initial start. And the other thing is you got to look, like, listen, governments spending money, borrowing from our future isn't inherently a bad thing if it produces the growth to pay it back, right? Like if you build a kick-ass highway and you're producing so much growth that now people can have jobs across town and we get to innovate and build factories and stuff, then maybe that's a good use of taking a loan out against our future so that we're entering the future with more capital than we had and we can pay it all back. Now, so what you want to look at is growth to GDP, right? Is your debt to GDP, excuse me. You want to look at how much they're borrowing versus how much growth they're producing. The problem is, you know, US debt to GDP is now well over 100%. Global debt to GDP is well over 300%. So there's so much borrowing and no growth. Now, if you're a government, if you're a central bank and you say, where can I find growth, right? Now, you can go found NVIDIA and Amazon. But not really, not if you're Senator Lummis, you can't, right? You're not Jeff Bezos, get the fuck out of here. So how do I get growth? Where can I just go buy growth off the shelf? Well, Bitcoin is 63% average over the last decade. For the record, the S&P 500 is somewhere between 7 to, you know, 10, maybe 14 at best. That's growth off the shelf you can just buy. And so when they say we also have a chance to maybe pay off the debt, is they're purchasing off-the-shelf growth, which everyone should do. That's what Saylor's doing, right? So anyway, that's kind of, you know, before we're talking about backing the dollar with Bitcoin and stuff, that's kind of my progression of thought, is they're obviously interested in growth, in votes, but they need growth, right? And they need to instill some confidence. And if you're not going to get the president to stop spending, if you need a defense budget for World War III, right? I think it would be a lot more nerve-wracking if they came out and said, we're going to stop spending on our military budget because of the deficits. I think there's a lot of America that would say, well, what if someone hits us with a bomb? I think you can instill more confidence and say, we hear you loud and clear. We're going to go after the hardest, most technologically advanced money of all time and really lean into this thing and be a leader. I think that's a first step of people being like, all right, you know, I got a little bit of confidence that they're not going to totally shit their pants here. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that, you know, in the near term, that's the reality of the proposals, which is huge.
Yeah, deal, think, by the way. You know, you're nailing it there too, right? I mean, I think the United States is in an interesting position because, you know, like we've said, you know, a couple times, El Salvador was the first one to do it, but there hasn't really been any other countries to kind of come forward. We had, what was it, like the Central African Republic kind of come out, but then I didn't really see much from them post that initial announcement, and we haven't really seen any other countries. So obviously the US as the global reserve currency, as the dollar, coming out and saying all these things is absolutely huge. And you know, you're talking about, you know, instilling some confidence into the United States public. Well, you know, I think at this point you're kind of lining out that the government has like a spending problem, right? No matter how much money they pull in, how much money they tax, they're always going to keep spending to make GDP kind of keep looking like it's growing and everything like that. Well, what do you take of the possibility of, you know, the government potentially printing US dollars to buy Bitcoin at this point? I mean, like theoretically, we're like the only country that could do that, right?
Are you looking for the best way to store your seed phrase? Well, I've got it for you. It's Stampseed. They've got the number one punch place where you can order a full-on package where they've got every single thing. They've got all the letters. You could just get it in there. And they've got this sick, sick hammer, which they've engineered to make it so easy for you to punch in that titanium steel plate and store your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. So go ahead and get your Bitcoin off of these exchanges and use promo code Green Candle for 15% off. They're helping power their show. They've got the Bitcoin logo. You can punch it into your seed phrase as well. If you could see it here, they've got a lot of cool stuff. And now I'm helping empower you to get your Bitcoin off an exchange utilizing Stampseed and storing your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. Now get to it. All right, back to the show.
Yes. I would love that. At the same time, I think it's dangerous and you won't see that anytime soon. Cause you're going to hyperinflate the dollar against Bitcoin, and there's not enough Bitcoin holders and there's far too many dollar holders for that to be net beneficial. Right. I mean, listen, I'm a Bitcoiner. I own a lot of Bitcoin. I'd love that. The reality is though, that, you know, you've hyperinflated the dollar against this hard asset that you're now effectively proposing as some form of currency or asset to be recognized globally. And you're going to put the thing worth millions of dollars per unit. And there's a lot of people that are going to, you know, just be, you know, broke as a skunk overnight. So I doubt they'll do that, and they'll ruin a lot. So it's important to understand Lummis's proposal. Her proposal is to hold and move confiscated assets to the Treasury and use excess reserves from the Fed banks. So money that's already there to actually accumulate, not debase actively the currency, which again, like as a Bitcoiner, I think you got to rip the Band-Aid, you got to print, and you got to just say, you know what, we fucked up, let's enter a new era. But do I think that's going to happen? No. Do I think that, you know, my buddies in high school that don't own any Bitcoin would love that? No, I don't. I think they'd be overnight destroyed. So I would price that reality as not very high, in my opinion. On the El Salvador stuff, you know, the one thing that's interesting about El Salvador is they don't have their own currency. So they went through a brutal civil war. I think everyone knows who El Salvador is now, but maybe not some of the history that's gotten them to the point of adopting Bitcoin. They went through a really bad civil war and lost their own currency. So they were on the dollar. That gives them some type of advantage in adopting something like Bitcoin, because they're not foregoing their own money printer. Because listen, if you owe debt, if you owe money in anything, let's say, Brandon, I owe you 10 Taylor Swift tickets. It's in my benefit that those get, quote unquote, debased, that those get cheaper, because it's easier for me to pay it back. You know, if each Taylor Swift ticket was what, at one point, like 10 grand. So if I owe you 10, I'm owing you 100 grand. But if the Taylor Swift tickets get, quote unquote, debased and each one's worth a buck, I owe 10 bucks. I can afford that. And so every government, it's in their best interest to continuously debase the currency, right? It's in their best interest. So, you know, if you have a money printer and you have a lot of debt, it's actually in your interest to continue to print, continue to debase, and continue to try. So, right, I think the United States has a unique problem in that they're the world reserve currency, and where they need people to be in demand for their debt, right? You know, like Ghana doesn't. Ghana doesn't have to convince China and Japan to buy their treasuries. But US does. And so I think that's where the difference is the US is like, well, shit, we're the leader of innovation, technology, democracy. We also need to debase our currency, though, right? Like Janet Yellen wants a weaker dollar. Trump's campaigning on a weaker dollar. That actually increases exports. It makes the export market better. So you want weaker dollar, but you want confidence. How the fuck are you going to do that? It's a lose-lose proposition, right? That's why we're in the position we're in. That's why Satoshi invented this whole thing. But how can the US use Bitcoin? Yeah, lean into democracy, technology, innovation, equality, right? In Bitcoin, everyone's treated equally, fair rights, no matter who you are, no matter your height, skin color, eye color, doesn't matter. And so you lean into that narrative and you start saying, we're going to innovate our way through this problem and try and instill confidence. So that's why I think it makes sense El Salvador adopt it. And it kind of makes sense that the US is going after it. And it makes a lot of sense why Ghana wouldn't really give a shit right now, right? So.
Yeah, 100%. And so, yeah, you kind of lined out like why we are where we are at this point in time. But, you know, where do you think we're going as far as like the Federal Reserve and like the interest rate policy, right? I mean, like yesterday, people were calling for an emergency rate cut and everything else. You know, they've kind of done what I like to call like closet QE, where they haven't necessarily lowered interest rates, but they've done quantitative easing in some way, shape, or form to kind of, you know, stop the bleeding in certain points in time. Well, you know, I guess like the Powell's mantra for this entire time has been higher for longer. You know, at the beginning of this year, I didn't think that we would see an interest rate cut until like Q4. Well, now it seems like it's almost an inevitability that we're going to see one in September because of, you know, what just happened yesterday. So, you know, what do you think of the job that Powell is doing? And, you know, where do you think we're going from here?
Are you looking for the easiest way to get your Bitcoin off an exchange? Well, I've got it for you. It's Foundation Devices. They've got the number one hardware wallet in the Passport. They've even got a concierge service that can help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange within 1 hour private onboarding session. And they've got a great app too, which will give you extremely, extremely, extremely private features on that app. So you can use Bitcoin in the most secure way possible. So I've been working hard trying to get sponsors to help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange. And I found it with Foundation. And you can store your seed phrase with a stamp seed punch plate as well. So pair all those together. Use promo code GREENCANDLE at foundation.xyz and you'll get $10 off your entire order. All right, that's enough for me. Back to the show.
Well, so I think it's important to understand the term fiscal dominance. It's an idea that, you know, what if Janet Yellen becomes Jerome Powell's boss? What if the US Treasury, so the government, is the one calling the shots on the currency? For context for your listeners, the Federal Reserve is supposed to be an independent bank. It's supposed to not care about the needs of the government. It's supposed to care about the needs of the currency and the economy, which also is full of shit. But it's less full of shit than just financing the government. But the world we live in today, in my opinion, Janet Yellen is effectively Jerome Powell's boss. That's a really, really important point because the problem Jerome Powell has is he's trying to beat inflation. He's trying to get it back down to his target, 2%, which, by the way, you know, inflation should be zero or negative, but whatever, we'll do 2%. The only way he can do that is continue deleting dollars, continue to raise rates, right? But that's not clearly what he's optimizing for. He's optimizing for an orderly market in treasuries, which is what Janet Yellen would want. So we live in a period of fiscal dominance. So what do I think he's going to do? If he actually cared and he was actually doing his job, you're right. He would have raised rates more. We'd be at 10% rates, 15% rates. All the banks are going to go under. But fuck the banks. Why would we care? You want to fix this problem? Remove the government guarantee that banks get bailed out. Remove FDIC insurance. Tell customers you can go anywhere. Stop criminalizing Bitcoin. Let people own what they want. Deposits will flee out of banks. Banks will be realized as insolvent. They'll all fall apart. We'll reset. If Jerome Powell could do what he wanted, that's probably around the range or direction that he would do. Maybe I'd be a more aggressive Fed chairman than Jerome Powell, but that's what he would do. He'd fix the problem, but he can't because his boss is Janet Yellen. And what Janet Yellen needs is one rule: no one sell their treasuries. No one. If Japan's in trouble, we open a dollar swap line because they're going to sell treasury. So the game is no one sell treasury. So if that's the game and you're going to continue to need to finance this market and this government, then you got to print. Then you got to print. So I think it's a fool's errand to say, you know, if I were the chairman of the Fed, what would I do? That's not the game. The game is if you had to finance the government and you had to finance your way out of all these deficits, what? Because Jerome Powell can't say, sorry, I don't care about those deficits. So then what does he have to do? He has to print money. And so whether that means lowering rates or not, I don't think is that important, right? Like there's a difference between the cost of money and the quantity of money, to your earlier point. He can still print without changing rates. Now we realize how important rates are by looking at what Japan just did, right? Rates are important. Like you can crash a lot of shit by clicking the wrong button. So not to say that he won't make changes and that they won't make changes and coordinate with other central banks around the world, but I don't really think it matters. I think they got to print a lot of money no matter what. And I think you're going to see one of the biggest asset bull markets in human history because according to the math of the money they have to print, you're going to get 2, 3, 4 COVIDs of money printing. So I think we're living in fiscal dominance, unfortunately, and it doesn't matter what Jerome Powell thinks or wants because his boss is the government.
Yeah. And I mean, I like the point you made there because I think, you know, once you start opening up the floodgates of the money printer, it essentially just gets more and more volatile, right? You're going to have to, you know, once the downward swings are bigger, you know, you're going to have to print more money to get out of it. And it's just a never ending cycle here, right? Which is essentially what we're seeing. Why, you know, just a measly 25 basis point hike from Japan is causing, you know, Lehman Brothers 2.0 here. So, you know, obviously you lined out a little bit earlier how things are potentially cracking, but you know, with and there could be another Lehman Brothers out there. But I want to get into more of like the corporate treasury aspect of Bitcoin because that seems to be a growing trend in, you know, the financial space. You know, obviously we've had Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy do it, but we've had, you know, 4 other companies like Similar Scientific, DeFi Technologies, and a few others come out and implement that strategy. Now, do you think that that's going to be, you know, another thing that's kind of growing and progressing as we're getting through this cycle and kind of why you're seeing or why you're predicting such a, you know, a big swing up? Because not only are we seeing nation states now start to talk about it, but we're also seeing, you know, companies kind of realize the importance of having some Bitcoin as on their corporate treasury.
Yeah, I mean, the big swing up is just dollar debasement, right? I think it's just a function of money printing. Bitcoin is the best expression of currency debasement. If you want to capture currency debasement, if you want to put option on the existing system, if you want to be long volatility, long chaos, if you want to monetize madness, the perfect thing to do is own Bitcoin. And so that's what I think, no matter what. I don't care if Saylor buys another one or not. I think the thing's going to the moon. But I think Saylor's genius. And I think that this strategy is just pure logic. What am I doing? I'm taking out debt in a thing that only goes down, and I'm hoarding and buying a thing that only goes up. Next question, right? I mean, what are we talking about? It's pretty straightforward. And so I think Saylor and others have found themselves a money printer. Now, we kind of covered this a little bit in the carry trade in Japan. You have to be able to finance it. And so the question is, you know, can Saylor and these guys finance all these loans, finance this debt, and carry the trade forward? You know, I think what we've seen with MicroStrategy and Michael is the obvious answer is absolutely. They have a profitable operating company. It's not necessarily growing or wildly impressive, but it doesn't have to be. And his ability to, you know, financially engineer sats per share has been brilliant. And the market has recognized that, and the company's gone from $500 million market cap to $30 billion market cap. And so I think Saylor's a genius. Now, how many companies can actually pull this off and do it and finance this level of debt? Again, you can't just like go public and do this. You know, Saylor's got a profitable operating company. MSTR is now like a meme. And so he's got persistent buying from Robinhood users, right? So we'll see who else can do this. But, you know, there's opportunity for other massive companies that have cash flow, that have a big balance sheet and can finance these things. But as far as, you know, like, did he one day spark a genius insight? No, the insight is pretty simple. A five-year-old can have the insight is, you know, I'll borrow the thing that only goes down persistently, and I'll get to buy and hoard the thing that only goes up. And if you do the math, I'm just going to make money every single year forever.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems obvious, right? I mean, you're lining it out here, right? A five-year-old could essentially think about it and, you know, come to the same conclusion. But it's interesting that not a lot of other companies have come to this just yet, or at least publicly traded, right? I mean, we've had Michael Dell start to tweet about Bitcoin, mm-hmm. and obviously, you know, Dell is a massive company, but they also just, you know, announced, I think it was like 12,000 layoffs are coming soon too. So the other day, so I mean, there does seem to be like some blood in the streets in some of these other companies. Now, I guess you mentioned the cash flow and like the steady cash flow that MicroStrategy has. You know, there's not a lot of companies that maybe have that just yet and the ability to put Bitcoin as a on their corporate treasury. But do you see that as like a growing trend as things maybe start to simmer down a little bit? Because obviously we're in some hectic times now, so there's volatility in the businesses. But, you know, once things start to level out, or do you think that, you know, because there is volatility in the businesses and in the overall economy, people are going to look for a safe haven asset on their treasury, such as Bitcoin?
Are you looking for the number one place to find all the information you can about Bitcoin, whether it's price, whether it's hash rate, whether it's the latest up-to-date things outside of Bitcoin, whether it's nation-state adoption, what have you? Well, I've got the place for you. Check out bitcoinnews.com. They've even got the number one newsletter in the game when it comes to Bitcoin, because it gives you all the up-to-date information on every single thing that happened in the past week. That'll come to your inbox every single Monday morning. You could sign up using this code right down here or this link. It's also in the show notes. So come join me and thousands of other people that are getting the most up-to-date information from bitcoinnews.com and their newsletter. All right, let's get back to the show.
I think so. You know, what Saylor's been able to achieve is more than meets the eye. He has full control over that business. He founded it and they went public a long time ago, and he had a lot of insight and foresight really in their structure and his control. And he did a great job with the board, selecting the board, educating the board. That's difficult. Let me just walk you through a scenario. Let's say you're a big tech public company, you know, maybe $50-100 billion tech company in the United States of America. You compensate your employees in stock options. This is a very common thing, right? Is that employees sign up, they get a salary, but they're really in it because they're going to get Meta stock or Amazon stock or whatever the hell. If you make a change, not even a Bitcoin change, but just a change where we say, we don't care about this upcoming quarterly earnings. We're changing our strategy. We're doing something big and different, and it's going to pay off years down the road. Well, the public markets are going to kill you for that. You know, there is no time, there's no low time preference in the fiat land in Wall Street. And so they're going to short the stock. Your stock's going to get crushed. Your stock gets crushed. All the compensation of your employees are crushed, right? Now your employees go from well-compensated, happy Silicon Valley engineers to poor. Your employees then leave. Your employees go to a competitor, and you've kind of just like totally unwound your company. And so I think it's very hard. You know, the one thing that Saylor had, and he talks about this, this isn't a diss. He said, we were dead in the water. We didn't have a choice. So, you know, if I were to go do this, it's not like the public markets could have buried us any further. And it's not like employees were going anywhere. It's either this or death. Now, that's not necessarily true for Amazon. So I think you've got complicated board structures, and you've got companies that are tied up in fiat nonsense. All right. Like, this is the web of spaghetti of fiat, is all of these equities. These things are people's savings accounts. These things are people's 401ks. These things are like everyone's future vacation, future engagement ring, future college tuition. And so they cannot make decisions like this without paying consequences, very likely from a fiat world. And there's cascading effects to that. So how does someone maneuver their way around without those dominoes falling? That's kind of, in my opinion, I'm just guessing. I mean, I don't know. I don't run a fucking public company, right? But I'm that's what I think. It's harder than you think, in my opinion. And so it's probably going to take either some market events or, you know, the US government adopting it, maybe new administration that doesn't criminalize Bitcoin. Maybe public sentiment changes a little bit, which allows for, you know, if the public markets heard that someone was adopting Bitcoin on as treasury instrument, that they wouldn't all freak out and short sell the stock. So that's kind of my speculative opinion. I think it's a little complicated. You know, Saylor, you know, is a unique situation and he deserves so much credit for what he's been able to do. But I don't think it's as easy to copy as people on Twitter think it is.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, you lined it out there, right? I mean, making board decisions when you have full complete power is a little bit easier than making them when you have a divided power and everything like that. But, you know, you dance around it a little bit, man. You're not running a publicly traded company, but you are running Strike. So how are you guys looking at putting Bitcoin on the corporate treasury if you're free to disclose that?
Yeah, I mean, we are a profitable business. We stack every day. So a lot of our revenue is in Bitcoin, and then we stack our cash flows every month. I mean, the way I run Strike is we treat it like two business lines internally. We have our operating company, which we, you know, people buy and sell Bitcoin with us. People do all sorts of Bitcoin stuff with us. We charge fees. We monetize it. We make more than we consume from the world. So I think of being profitable as almost like a moral obligation before a financial one. It's you're doing more for the world than you're taking from the world, right? And that's technically making the world a better place, is if you're producing more goods and services that people value than you're taking from, right? And so that's been important to us. And I think that also gives our customers trust in us and allows them to value, like, we're not going anywhere. We're here for the long haul. We're a business that's sustainable and that's here to last. We're not reliant on venture or whatever. And so that's our operating company. Then we've got our treasury business, which I call it a business, although it's just sats. But if you think of it like a business, like this business line of ours grows on average over the last decade, 63% year over year, right? And it's over 100% over the last 12 months. And that's a fast growing business line. And so if you think of it like a business line, you're like, well, hold on a second. If some employee of mine wants to start a project or go off and invest in some new idea, the question internally at the company is, are you going to beat Bitcoin? Are you going to beat 63%? Because if not, we're just going to pour our capital into sats. And so it creates like a really competitive, interesting culture internally where we only do things that are going to outperform Bitcoin. So we've created at Strike like a machine. You know, we're probably one of the only businesses in the world that can outperform Bitcoin. It's because that's what I've tasked the team to do. So it's cool. It's awesome. We stack a lot of sats. You know, there's part of me that, you know, is jealous of Saylor. He gets to borrow a lot of money and buy a lot of Bitcoin. But I think the public markets are dangerous. Like I said, if you compensate your employees in stock options, then you are a victim of whatever the public market decides to price your stock at. If you make a decision and they say, I don't like that, they can unwind your entire company, short sell the stock, make the employees quit, and you're ruined. And so I don't know. I like the way we do it. We're just Bitcoiners focused on stacking sats and providing value to customers.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that that's unique though now, which is kind of surprising and like almost outlandish to say, because, you know, we obviously saw like the tech boom from 2010 to 2020, where we basically every company tried to go on the Amazon model, where essentially they kept borrowing until Amazon found its AWS and exploded. Yep. Where now it's like, all right, in tougher economic times, it just makes more sense to be a straight cash flowing business. Now with all of that as well, you guys have actually had like a significant amount of growth, right? I mean, I think last year at the conference, you announced you're in over 100 countries, excuse me, mm-hmm. and you're continuing to grow. So how are you managing that aspect of things where maybe putting money into growth where it's kind of shaky economic times, also putting Bitcoin on the treasury, you know, kind of balancing all of that as, you know, Strike is continuing to grow?
You know what, man? Like, so what Bitcoin does to our business is it just brings back common sense, brings back low time preference. You know, like, how do you guys manage hiring? I tell you how. We hire who we need. What the fuck kind of question is that, right? But like, common sense gets lost in, you know, if your business is only priced and valued on growth, it's a lot trickier of a question. You know, if you were to give a big tech company $1 billion worth of cash, they'd have to deploy it and spend it into growth immediately because the public markets don't care about their cash. The public markets don't care about anything other than each quarterly earnings. Are you hitting the quota? Are you growing so that we can multiply the growth forward? And for Strike, we don't have to do that. If you gave me $1 billion, I probably wouldn't hire a fucking soul, but I'd put it to work tomorrow. What would I do? I'd buy $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. So, you know, if the capital is actually worth something, it's backed by time and energy, and it can actually increase purchasing power and work for you, and you can store it, put it under your mattress, and it's worth more tomorrow than it was yesterday, it changes everything. So we only hire as necessary. We only focus on making our customers happy. Customers are the most important thing to us. We care deeply about Bitcoiners. That's actually one of the things I think differentiates us is that we are Bitcoiners. You know, a lot of people that serve Bitcoin products don't necessarily like Bitcoiners. Like, I don't think Coinbase, you know, likes Bitcoin Core, likes Bitcoiners, likes the Lightning Network, right? So, I don't know, customer focus, low time preference. We just do logical things that make sense. And we can afford to because of Bitcoin. If I had to build this business without Bitcoin and it was about growth, 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 it'd be a much more interesting question. It'd be like, well, shit, I don't know. We're going to try and invent, you know, the Bitcoin infinity machine or whatever. You'd have to come up with wild, crazy shit. But we don't. We just listen to customers and the market has rewarded us. I mean, we've grown a lot. It's a successful business. We're super proud of it. And I think the last unique thing about Strike is, you know, we've got 100 years of work to do at minimum, which is very rare, right? You know, like not a lot of companies have 100 years of work to do. Visions don't last that long usually. And so we just try and stay humble. And if we're around in 100 years, you know, I'd be very proud of that.
Yeah, there we go. Stay humble and stack sats, right? We're Dodell on that one. But you guys have, definitely kind of gone a few different places, it seems like, in the Bitcoin space. You've made a lot of big announcements. You have, you know, like the white glove service now. You have some help for businesses to help them hold Bitcoin on their corporate treasuries. Now, how have you seen, I guess, maybe the development of your business as a whole? You know, you said you got like a 100-year outlook, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe focusing on one thing at a certain time or focusing on another thing. How are you looking at like just pivoting and navigating through this? Because obviously, you know, as Bitcoin's very volatile, so is entrepreneurship and growing and scaling a business. Yeah. So how are you looking at just like navigating all of that, especially, you know, when we got, a lot of ups and downs since you started Strike with COVID and what we got going on now.
Are you looking for the best way to orange pill your friends and family? Well, I've got a way for you that's got a little bit of a nostalgia factor. I've got Bitcoin trading cards. They've got the Genesis pack. I've got an open pack right here sitting here where you can hand out a bunch of these cards with some great, great artwork. We've got Tyranny. We've got Fear, Uncertainty, and Doubt right here, the FUD card. So we've got a lot of great things to teach you a bunch of lessons about Bitcoin in the current space. And they've even got some cool things of cool people even doing some stuff in the Bitcoin space. I've got the Bitcoin racing card here, even signed by my boy, Chris Primetime McKenzie. So you can get all of that at btc-tc.com. Use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order to orange pill your friends and family and collect some cool artwork of people that are doing some awesome stuff in the Bitcoin space and help spreading that orange pill around the globe. All right, enough from me. Back to the show.
Yeah. No, this has been entrepreneurship is a son of a bitch. There's no doubt about that. I've got some stories for sure. The inside scoop on Strike, man, is this. When I founded it, I was very early to Lightning. I thought Lightning was underinvested and underappreciated. Still do. Our Lightning products still grow very organically. But what happened is the market fell apart. That 2022 bear market through a lot of 2023, FTX went under. And, you know, when I got into Bitcoin 11 years ago, I thought Mt. Gox was going to be the Bitcoin company for the world, or one of which. the best Bitcoin wallet services, the best Bitcoin on and off ramps, the leading in Bitcoin technology, that have the newest features, the newest developments, the best customer service. Well, turns out that didn't happen, right? But then sure enough, Coinbase and Brian Armstrong would do it. Someone came along, got Mark Andreessen involved, A16Z, Silicon Valley funded, San Francisco, but they didn't seem to want that either, right? They're much more interested in Ethereum and crypto. And it was like, okay, but then Sam Bankman-Fried and Binance and CZ, I mean, those guys got more money than God and they seem to be way smarter than everyone else, but now they're both in jail. And so I think what we realized at Strike is we looked around, we're like, hold on a second, because we were getting so much demand from Bitcoiners of like, you know, we love Lightning and the vision and stuff, but like, how about giving us buy sell? How about giving us good on-chain wallet? How about giving us a private client service? How about giving us killer customer support? And we kind of looked internally and we were like, wait, we're the most regulated Bitcoin company in the world right now. We've got some of the best technology in the world right now. You know, are we the most principled, ethical, technologically talented, product-oriented, customer-focused Bitcoin company on planet Earth? And the answer was, yeah. Everyone else was either focused on shitcoins or in jail. And so never in a million years did I think that I'd be able to head a company that can compete for being the best in the world for Bitcoiners at Bitcoin. And when we say at Bitcoin, buy, sell, store, send, receive, Lightning wallet, API features, private client services, customer support. And so that's kind of what we've become more broadly. And it's been killer in every aspect. And, you know, the market tells the truth. Ultimately, the market is the judge. And so you can see it in our growth and in our numbers. But that's kind of the inside scoop in Strike, really. And so what we build next is what customers want from us. I kind of changed from going, you know, my job is to predict the future, to my job is to just listen to my customers and work as hard as I can for Bitcoiners. And once you make that change internally, it was pretty obvious what we do. It's what the market needs from us.
Yeah, and I think that'll help continue Strike to grow and prosper here in the future. But, you know, we're recording this on August 6th. Obviously, we've had, you know, some turmoil in the market. So I'm going to put you on the spot here. I want to give you the time to make a prediction. What you think how we're going to end the rest of this year, not only for, I guess, Bitcoin and global markets, but also if you got something like exciting coming up for Strike as well.
As far as price action ending this year, I think we're at or over 100K. I think shit hits the fan probably September, especially in Q4, for sure. You know, the other thing about August and summer markets, especially post-halvings and stuff in election cycles, is, you know, everyone that's rich and important goes on vacation. It's hard to make really bad decisions or stupid decisions when you're in the Hamptons or whatever. So I think people start getting back from their vacations. Politicians got to win elections. They're going to be promising a bunch of free shit that isn't actually free. And who knows, like maybe Biden and the Democrats prove that they're war hawks and they go commit troops. You know, maybe they come out with stimulus packages. Maybe Japan tightens a little further and we need bailouts. And so I think things actually start to move aggressively in Q4 and you see this thing catch up to where it's supposed to be. I think Bitcoin is dislocated and mispriced. So that's my prediction. And then I think we really aggressively blow off in 2025. So I think we end the year, you know, 100K, 125K or something, and you can see a Bitcoin price as high as 500, 600, 700K in 25 or maybe the beginning of 26. I think it blows off. And, you know, there's a hangover to that. Money printing is like drinking, right? You have enough of it. You think everything's free and cool and you're the best and every girl wants your number and everything. And then you got to wake up in the morning and face reality. And so printing money isn't tied to the physical world. And so we'll have a correction, but that's kind of my prediction of this cycle. And I think it's just highly predicated on the sovereign debt market and the macro global relationships that are falling apart right now. And for Strike, I mean, listen, I think, like you said, we're in over 100 markets. We're the leader in many respects when it comes to Bitcoin and technology and our products and our pure focus. If you want to be the best in the world at anything, it's got to be your only sole focus. And so I think we have an opportunity over the next, you know, 1, 5, 10 years to be the primary financial account for hundreds of millions of people as Bitcoin becomes a world reserve currency. And so you can kind of guess our roadmap from there. Like our customers want loans. Our customers want insurance. They have car insurance, home insurance. They want Bitcoin insurance. They want different custody models. They want cards. They want all sorts of fun and cool things. They want us to be in Japan. They want us to be have a better presence in Brazil. And so I think everyone can kind of see that vision. The difficulty is just executing properly. So we'll keep listening to customers, but I think the future is pretty obvious if you're a Bitcoiner, and we're going to try and make it happen.
There we go. Great stuff. But I know you're not talking about me when you're saying not everybody in the girl and not every girl in the bar wants you, right? I mean, come on, Jack, but I'm giving you a hard time here. So you are a Chicagoan, and I am as well. I was born in Park Ridge some time ago. I'm not going to date myself just yet, but I have some rapid fire Chicago-based questions for you so we can give the people a little bit of a peek onto who Jack Mahlers is. So Jack, first question. Any Chicagoanite knows this question, but does ketchup belong on a hot dog?
Well, you know, it's funny. A Chicagoan answer is no, but my answer is yes. I'm ketchup only on my hot dog.
Jack, you're killing me on that, man. All right. So then deep dish or flat style or like the thin crust?
This is another difficult one where we're supposed to be known for deep dish, but deep dish is a scam. I think it's gross. And I would say, in my opinion, Chicago dog is another obvious tourist attraction. But if you come to Chicago and you want local food, I'd say you got to eat Chicago fried chicken. Chicago's got a really big hip hop scene, like Kanye West, Chance the Rapper, Chief Keef. There's a lot of modern hip hop and culture from Chicago. And if you go down West Loop area or down south, you can get some of the most famous fried chicken. Kendrick Lamar often drops lyrics about Chicago fried chicken. So if you're a tourist and you want to get scammed, you want the Ethereum and the Cardano of Chicago, you can have a bullshit Chicago dog and deep dish. But if you want Bitcoin, I'd get some Harold's fried chicken.
There we go, man. Hey, I like the peek behind the hood. Okay, last question here. Oh, no, I got two more for you.
And steak, by the way. And steak. So I'm more a carnivore diet guy, and so Chicago's probably the best steakhouses in the world. Midwest, obvious. But anyway, sorry, didn't want to interrupt.
Well, Chicago's got some of the best food in the world, too. So if you want a place in Greektown, I can tell you my family's spots here after. I don't want to blow it up too much, though. North or South Side? So Cubs or Sox, dude?
I grew up on the North Side, but I was raised a Sox fan, which is unfortunate. We're the worst team in Major League Baseball by far. But I grew up a Sox fan, albeit growing up on the North Side.
Man, that's tough. I think you guys are currently like a 21-game losing streak as we're recording this right now. And then
all Chicago sports is real bad. You know, my dream, I've said this on a Peter McCormick podcast recently, I'd love to be the mayor of Chicago someday. I think the city needs a little bit better leadership. And then after that, I'd love to own. If I got my pick, I'd choose the Chicago Bulls. But I think we need new ownership and leadership. And so that's my mission through stacking sats. Hopefully I have an opportunity to do that. So yes, the Sox stink, but so do the Bulls, so do the Bears, so do the Cubs. I mean, maybe, I don't know, what are the Bears' odds to make the playoffs? So pick them this year. We'll see. Anyway, yeah, it's a bad time to be a Chicago sports fan overall.
Yeah, they're saying it's like the worst time to be a Chicago sports fan is right now because like all you lined out. But I have hope for Caleb Williams. So the last question, how many Super Bowls do you think Caleb Williams is going to win with the Bears, 6 or 7?
Seven, I guess. I mean, we'll see. I mean, you, as a Bear fan, you go through this over and over and over and over again. Probably after his first 10 snaps, he'll be the best quarterback in franchise history. But if you go back and you look at tweets and media coverage of Justin Fields, it was a lot of the same rhetoric. Now, Caleb is maybe a bit more generational, but nonetheless, you know, I need a little bit of proof of work if I were to carry some Bitcoin analogy and rhetoric. The guy hasn't taken a professional snap yet. So we'll see. I'm obviously optimistic, but Bear fans have just been through too much for me to parade this guy around like LeBron James in Miami. He was the one, 6, 7, 8. That, you know, LeBron, is, it doesn't get more fiat than LeBron James. So let's see some proof of work. Let's see if he can lead a locker room.
Amen, man. Amen. Yeah, I always like to joke around with that. But yeah, it's been a rough go. I was all in on Mitch. I was all in on Justin Fields. So I don't know what I'm going to do if Caleb flops too. But,
yeah, I mean, we would have won a Super Bowl if we didn't have Rex Grossman under center in the Devin Hester era. I mean, Kyle Orton is probably like the most performant Bears playoff quarterback since I've been alive. And we paid a lot of money to Jay Cutler. It's been brutal. So, we'll see. I mean, I'm pulling for the guy and we've surely spent a lot of money and optimized for him. This is the first Bears offense where we might throw, we might design plays longer than 7 yards. You know, the Bears is screenplay, draw, punt. So we'll see. I mean, I'm optimistic, but, I don't know.
Yeah, man, me too. I'm about as optimistic as you, man. I mean, as optimistic as we can be. But Jack, you've been very generous with your time. I appreciate you coming on the show. Why don't you tell people where they can learn more about you and more about Strike?
On the internet, man. Jack Mallers is my real name. First name is not John. It is Jack. So that's my handle pretty much everywhere. And at Strike, we try to make ourselves accessible. Like, we care about things like customer support. So you can DM me even on Twitter if you have an issue, and we're here to help. So you can find me on the web, and I'll be around.
Awesome stuff, Jack. Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in to the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here. And you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.